This is a podcast for Wednesday, November 27th, 2013, Ethics, and we're finishing up with Aristotle today. Okay, so, I'm wearing my Aristotle shirt today, too. Not by accident, either. So, somebody define what does this word mean? How do you pronounce this word? It's all Greek.
Well, yeah.
You have in your notes in the English transliteration.
Eudaimonia?
Close. Eudaimonia. I think it doesn't even have a little accent here. So I can't really see it. Oh, yeah, here it is, like right here, right? Eudaimonia. Yeah, human flourishing, not virtue. Virtue is a different word, which is, starts with an A. Talk like a pirate.
It sounds like what?
I said it sounds like, it starts with an A, talk like a pirate. Arete. Did we talk about arete yet? Yeah, I thought I'd give that a turn out. Maybe not.
Arete.
So arete is virtue, so. Let's see. Maybe I didn't stick that up in my PowerPoint. I should have. It's in the text. So eudaimonia is the goal, success in life, human flourishing, being the person you were meant to be, given your human nature, fully actualizing your potential as a rational animal. So that's the goal. And then how do you get there? Well, you need certain character traits. You need discipline. You need ambition. You need self-control. You also need generosity, and you need honesty, and you need courage. Right. So all these are virtues. They're not an impersonal obligation towards others. They're traits that will help you live a more successful life. That's going to make you a better person. And then if everybody's doing that, and if you're teaching your children to do that, then you have the great society sort of comes about on its own. It's not as if there's a difference between your duty to yourself and your duty to others. In fulfilling your duty to yourself and becoming a better person, you're automatically improving society. And so if you create the good life for yourself, you're going to create the good life for society. And that's one of the sort of appealing things about Aristotle, is that there's no distinction in Aristotle between the good life in the sort of natural sense of living the good life and having all the things that people want and desire, and the good life in the moral sense of living a good life, of, you know, being a moral person. Those are the same thing in Aristotle. Let's see, where are we at? And of course, for Aristotle, it's all about being an intellectual. We talked last time, you know, is human nature really a rational animal, and how narrowly do you construe that? For the purpose of the test, you could just say that, you know, Aristotle says that what human beings do best is reason, and therefore some form of the intellectual life is most appropriate for man, as sort of the height of human flourishing is a life which fully engages the mind. And people that are bricklayers and like going to monster truck rallies and don't really read books, Aristotle says they're not really fully actualized as a human being. They're, you know, they can actualize their own potential, whatever it is, but they're not going to be a great human being. You could be a good human being, though, if you're doing things like, if you live according to those virtues, if you pay your bills, if you're not a drunk, if you're a good friend, you can still be a good person. But to be like the pinnacle of human achievement, you know, you need to be a scholar, a philosopher, a scientist, you know, something where you're using your mind. Oh, here we go. I guess I shouldn't blame you because this is where we left off. So virtue, arete. Oh, actually, no, that's not where we left off. I'm incorrect. When I make a mistake, I admit it. That's probably an old reference for most people in this class.
Examples of virtues.
Right. So just, you know, the briefest review, what's the goal? Eudaimonia, success. How do you get there? Virtue, arete. Arete, character traits which lead you to success. character trait is just a disposition to act in a certain way. It's a habit. Virtues are, again, they're in the middle between too much of something and too little of something, an excess and deficiency. And you start out with a basis of a good upbringing, and then after that, you practice. So, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, 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 right? How do you become a virtuous person? Practice virtue. You try being virtuous. You try acts of courage. Like, I know someone that has extreme social anxiety. And so he started going to this choir class and was, like, totally freaked out about it, having panic attacks, having to get up and leave in the middle. But after a while, you kind of get used to it, and you're around people long enough, and the anxiety dissipates, and then you kind of, like, get used to it. But at first, you have to, like, face the fear and do it anyway. And so it's this sort of, you know, dealing with the panic, dealing with the anxiety, trying again, trying means of self-control, trying to control volatile emotions, trying to control your autonomic nervous system when it's going haywire. And eventually, he learned how to be around people and be fairly comfortable about it, even though he had stressed out getting ready for choir. So, it's like that with any of these virtues, self-control, or like, you know, a certain relation of mine who's a drunk and went to rehab for 30 days and is falling off the wagon again and lately had a row with his girlfriend because he's way overdid on the drinking and she's not talking to him now. And now he's like, I got it under control now, at least for the time being. So, you know, he's learning. I think eventually, like, I've known people reformed drunks and they, you know, kicked the bottle eventually. And it was just like, it's trial and error. You try all these things, and you fall off the wagon, you try to get back on the wagon, and eventually it takes, and it's all about practice. So we talk. Here's where we left off. Christianity, that's where we left off. So Christianity made a couple of changes to Aristotle's theory. So you get Thomas Aquinas that sort of adopts it, and Aristotle becomes the kind of patron philosopher of Christianity, patron saint of philosophers in Christianity. And the philosopher Thomas Aquinas kind of adopts Aristotle's philosophy and gives it a Christian spin. And it's sort of the height of medieval philosophy. It's Aristotle and the Bible through Thomas Aquinas. And so Christianity adds faith and love as virtue and has less emphasis on reason. Now, Aquinas is actually, he's a really smart guy. He's very insightful. He makes, like, really elegant arguments and distinctions. He's very logical and methodical and reasoning from, you know, the premises he's reasoning from. He's a pretty damn good philosopher. There is this element that, you know, certain things can only be known through faith. And so there's this kind of irrational or irrational element added, which Aristotle would have liked at all. like Thomas Aquinas does, like, natural philosophy. Like, he gives arguments to prove the existence of God. A lot of Aquinas about natural law, ethics, the idea that human beings are made a certain way, we're designed to function a certain way, and therefore certain things are appropriate and inappropriate. And then Christianity also added this idea of love as being part of ethics, that you're supposed to love your enemies, and the most important, like if you look at Romans 13, the Apostle Paul says that the most important virtue is love. And another change that Christianity made is replacing pride as a virtue. Pride gets replaced by humility, and servitude becomes the kind of the pinnacle of human achievement. Christianity says, Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. Cross is an instrument of torture and death. Right, so what are you supposed to do? Sacrifice everything and follow Jesus. And selfish desires and the ego are seen as bad. This world and all its trappings is coming to an end. Being too caught up in the lust of the eyes, the flesh, and the pride of life is I think that's from one of the letters of John. is seen as bad. You're not supposed to be worldly. You're a sojourner in this vale of tears, and eventually it'll be over, and you'll have heavenly reward. So all those things, I think, are a big break from Aristotle, where Aristotle would say, no, glory in life. Enjoy your life to the fullest. Servitude is for slaves. This idea of, like, humbling yourself and thinking about serving humanity or serving God, it's kind of shows you got low self-esteem and you're kind of like a battered spouse or something like that. Aristotle would think that's not how to live as a human being. Human beings, you need to live with your chin up and, you know, face forward and trudging on and you know, seize the day, right? The old the Latin phrase, carpe diem, you know, seize the day. Aristotle would agree with that. No, he didn't. He's Greek, and that's a Latin. I'm not sure where that came from. I guess it's just like an old Roman saying. Aristotle predates it by at least a few hundred years. They have little coffee mugs that say that. When you drink a lot of coffee, that's how you feel. Carpe diem. Yeah. Did you have a question or just?
No.
Oh. Comments or questions about that? About the Christian spin on Aristotle or
whether?
Good question. I think not. Some of the things on the test will be on the PowerPoint, but not in the reading, and vice versa. And, you know, stuff we talk about in class, anything's fair game. I think there's a question on the study guide about this, though. So what do you think? Aristotle Christianity?
Aristotle. And I don't like Aristotle.
You don't like Aristotle? Is this because he's a sexist?
Yeah, I think so.
What if he wasn't a sexist? I mean,
I like it better.
Give a guy a break.
You
know, well, Abraham Lincoln wanted all of the black people to go back to Africa. I mean, so, you know, he's a racist,
I know,
too.
I know. He didn't.
But do you, like, hate Abraham Lincoln, though? Because he's a racist?
I don't think he's a great man.
Okay.
Because it was over money, I think, that he freed the slaves in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, actually, there's a book called, I like using Lincoln because people kind of worship him. There's a book called, there's a giant statue in Washington of him up on the chair, right? And people go there to make their pilgrimage. But there's a book called, The Real Lincoln or something like that? The Honest Truth About Honest Abe or something like that. Thomas DiLorenzo has written a couple of books. Unmasking Lincoln is another one where he sort of, you know, shows that he's just like a crony, I don't like the phrase crony capitalism, because crony capitalism is phony capitalism. But he's like a, you know, like the usual guy. He's in bed with the railroads and getting lots of money from them, and a politician. He only freed the slaves, like the Emancipation Proclamation, freedom in the South, and so on. But we're going a little astray here. Think of another example. I think any of these philosophers, you can look at, you know, their personal lives. And some of their views, which are, you know, maybe a product of their times, like or people that have just really eccentric views, like usually when you look at great people, they have, like, there's this one thing that's like, that's kind of wacko, but like the rest of their stuff is brilliant, but there's this one thing that kind of like way off. And sometimes it's just something that was floating around the culture that everybody else believed, and so they believed it too. Sometimes it's just an eccentricity. So, you know, cut these philosophers a little slack. Like Nietzsche probably had syphilis or, you know, went insane at the end of his life. But that doesn't mean he's a bad philosopher, that anything he said is just the product of madness. He went mad at the end of his life, but it doesn't mean that he was crazy all along, as some people will say.
What I wonder if Aristotle, some of the beliefs were time. I wonder if there weren't more enlightened people, because there have throughout history been people who, in the face of, I would say, like what we wouldn't call enlightened views, are enlightened and have like this feeling that everyone should have equal rights.
So there were people like that. Like a lot of the Greeks had those sorts of ideas. You know, it wasn't like they weren't quite evolved, like the idea that all, you know, citizens of Athens are supposed to have equal rights, but slaves who were like captured in war, no, or women.
There seems like there should have been some people whose beliefs transcended that, because those are like natural rights. So
yeah, I think there are a few. Like you look at some of the playwrights, like Lysistrata, So in Lysistrata, it's during the Peloponnesian War, and the playwright Euripides, Sophocles, Thucydides. Thucydides is a historian. It's a comedy. Is it? I should know this. Like I used to know all of the. Do you remember?
Oh no.
I need to Google it right now. Who wrote Lysistrata? Is it Aristophanes?
Yes.
Aristophanes of the clouds. Yeah. So Aristophanes wrote Lysistrata, and it basically the plot is the Peloponnesian War is going on. The women are sick of the men fighting over petty things, and so they all hold up in the Parthenon. Basically, they're not going to put out until the men make peace. Yeah, great. The world's first sex comedy. What's that?
They have servants' boys.
Yeah, well, I suppose. Yeah, maybe it's unrealistic, historically inaccurate, maybe. But anyway, that's the idea. I remember we were actually reading this, and I was taking ancient Greek, and there's this middle-aged woman who's like taking Greek to learn how to read the Bible in ancient Greek, and we're reading this play, and we're reading and translating as we go, and I said, "What's that you got in your hand?" And then she's like, "There's like this long hesitation," and then the instructor says, "It's a word for penis." So it's like it's this ribald comedy, right? But the point of this is like that. There were people like Aristophanes who like poked fun at the status quo and about war and about gender inequality and so on.
And I think Aristotle maybe represents like the common acceptance, like you said, the ones in power were men, mm-hmm. who weren't slaves.
Right.
So they were like, yeah, he's cool, and I think that's why he's become so famous. I think those other people maybe aren't as because their beliefs weren't.
Well, Plato was an egalitarian. He has men exercising in the gymnasium next to women. Women have equal rights in the Republic.
Well, I like Plato.
Yeah.
But Aristotle seems more popular than Plato.
Really? No, Plato. I think Plato gets a lot more play than Aristotle. Maybe because it came first. There's a lot of good stuff in Plato, don't get me wrong.
Maybe
just like
we're focusing more on Aristotle. We didn't have a whole chapter on Plato.
Well, Plato didn't write very much. Plato has, and we had like the Euthyphro, but Plato didn't really develop a system of ethics per se, the way Aristotle did. So that's the main reason why. And Aristotle represents like a third resurgent strain of ethics, whereas Plato didn't really. He did some like the thing about religion and ethics, and he wrote a lot about like sort of weakness of will and some other. There's some stuff about ethics, but it's we looked at the stuff in the Republic on justice and why is justice good for the individual, and that's about ethics. So.
But so Aristotle, though, it's at the same level as utilitarianism and deontology.
Yeah, it's sort of like I would say utilitarianism and deontology are sort of the big two, and then the sort of third trait, and third and gaining, it's Aristotle, coming around the bend and has like really enjoyed since the 70s, become really like a pillar of modern ethics. And then you got all these trendy things like care ethics and stuff coming up along the side of it too. Yeah.
I think it's kind of hard though to put Christianity in Aristotle virtue ethics together.
Mm-hmm.
Just like pride and humility, they're both so different, and it's just like, in church, they all will tell you it's better for you to like pray at home. I mean, not everyone's like that, obviously.
Right?
But just like it's a personal thing that don't be like shoving your stuff in people's faces, and then also it's like a lot about servitude, serving God, or even the things that you produce. I think like you said last week, you're like, oh, this was all because of God, I don't know. I feel like it'd be really hard to. Because I feel like the first one, it's not saying that you don't have a duty to anybody else. You're taking care of everybody, but it's more like about like yourself. And
mm-hmm.
Christianity is kind of about.
It's about other people, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a bit in the book of James where it says, you people, you're so prideful, you say, oh, tomorrow we'll go to such and such a business, such and such a city and do business. Where you ought to say, if the Lord wills, then we'll go to such and such city and do business. And it's all about sort of thinking everything happens at God's sovereign good pleasure, and you shouldn't think too highly of yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think when when Christianity grabbed Aristotle's ethics, they disconcerned his views and his thing, and they just used his mechanism to place their own virtues above his, and his doesn't even matter anymore, and then kind of just his was the standard at the beginning, right?
Yeah, so I would say it seems to me it is more of a synthesis. I could see how you might say that they're basically stealing the shell and sort of putting all the Christian values. And that's actually what a lot of what Nietzsche says, is that Aristotle is being flipped upside down, and you get these values of classical civilization, which are all about the individual and about achievement and about strength and courage and flourishing and getting the most out of life. And it's, this life sucks, and it's going to end with the apocalypse any day now, and you could die tomorrow, and then the most important thing is, are you going to heaven or hell? And you're always worrying about going to hell, and every time you want to do something fun, get drunk or have sex, you're worried about God's going to be angry at you and punish you, and so it sort of takes all the joy out of life, according to Nietzsche. And actually, it might be a good segue. I think we're almost there. Oh, poverty. Poverty is a virtue. You look at all the monks take a vow of poverty. Whereas Aristotle says, look, to have a good life, you got to have money. You have to at least have enough money to not worry about it.
Know what Bob Marley said. If you know what life is worth, you'll look for years on earth. Basically mm-hmm. saying, don't listen to the meek inherit the earth. Mm-hmm. It's like a trick.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to. The whole idea of the meek shall inherit the earth. And Aristotle would say meekness is a vice, and Nietzsche would agree. And Nietzsche, is really sort of classical civilization coming back against the Christian interpretation of Aristotle and about Christianity generally. So just some pluses for virtue ethics. How do you know what's right and wrong? That's the question students always ask in this class. And I always go back to relativism. Whatever I believe in my heart is true for me. Which is the most ridiculous thing a person could ever say, except for 1 and 1 is 3. or 1 and 1 is 2, but God adds 1, making 3. Or whatever. Or actually, no, what is it? It's 1 and 1 is 3, and God takes away 1, always making it 2. There's a theory of mathematics for you based on faith. But the advantages of Aristotle's ethics is you can tell what's right and wrong. How do you tell? Well, look at the results. Look at, what's the goal? Human flourishing. How do you get there? Virtue. Well, what's a virtue? Well, if any trait that makes you successful in life is going to be a virtue. So you can tell, like being an honest person, honesty and being a good friend and being a hard worker and having courage. I mean, all those things sort of help you get ahead. You look at great people. Now, there is exceptions, right? But you look at generally, what qualities help you get ahead in life. And you can sort of list them down, and they're not, rocket science. And so that rather than doing this torture thing with Kant where you try to imagine a world where everybody does it, or utilitarianism where you're kind of trying to calculate out things, this makes a lot of intuitive sense.
What about David Hume?
Hume's a skeptic about morality. And that's kind of an interesting counterpoint to Aristotle. Aristotle says, Aristotle might say, if you think that ethics is something which is a priori, which is sort of intuited by the mind, by pure reason, then if I thought that, I'd be a skeptic too. But he says, no, ethics isn't about intuiting what my impersonal duty to others is. Ethics is about how I become successful. And so given that I want to live a good life and be a good person and have a successful life, I need some general guidelines about how to do that. I need to cultivate some habits in myself that will make me a successful person. And that's the science of ethics for Aristotle. It's very practical, very down to earth, based on character, based on human psychology, based on just it's a practical philosophy, as opposed to Kant or Mill, where it's much more theoretical. And so, Hume just says, well, since you can't prove ethics a priori, you can't derive an ought from an is, you can't prove it's wrong to torture babies for fun, then it's all a bunch of nonsense. It's all these weird feelings that we have based on human nature that don't really mean anything. And Aristotle would say, no, it's not about feelings. It's about what character traits that you need to cultivate in yourself to get what you want out of life, to have a good life. And there's no dichotomy between the good for you and the good for others, because they sort of coincide in that if you cultivate these virtues in yourself, they'll automatically benefit society. So similar to I suppose to Rand's view. So really what's good for you is good for other people. So even though, I tried to poke holes of that in the egoism and justice thing, I think generally speaking, particularly if you live in a advanced civilization like ancient Greece or like ours today, all the virtues really do pay. And you look at people that go around breaking traditional moral rules, and I'm just thinking about not just sort of puritanical cultural norms, but thinking about harming other people. People that go around harming others, they usually end up in jail or suicidal or in some sort of bad way killed. You look at your drug dealers and your criminals and even your corporate raiders, they end up having a heart attack or having a string of failed relationships or what have you. Being unhappy, making a lot of money, but not really being happy, always wanting more, always being dissatisfied, never feeling fulfilled, maybe under the shadow of their father who always expected them to excel and feeling that pressure even though their father's been dead for 20 years. And people have all sorts of things that kind of drive them forward. But you look at the people who are really happy and fulfilled, they tend to have certain characteristics and traits, and Aristotle's trying to pick out what those are. And he also, a good thing is Aristotle understands the role of judgment, that you can't always have a rule that applies to every case. There are certain things that you just have to practice to know. I remember learning to drive a stick shift car when I was I was in my mid-20s. And I'd never driven a stick before, and it terrified me. And I finally, I tried to go with my wife, and she'd be telling me, okay, first you ease down on the clutch, and then you or ease up on the clutch while you push down the accelerator. And I tried to do it, the car would lurch forward, right? And after a while, it just wasn't working. And so finally, I paid some driving school. The guy was really good at starting me off, and so I got the fundamentals, which might be analogous to what you do with your kids when you teach them basic things. And then after a while of practicing, I got the basics, and then I finished the course, and I just drive around and I practice stopping and going in first gear, which is where the real problems are, right? And I'd stall out and I'd figure out, oh, okay, my car is a little different than the driver ed car. I have to ease off a little easier on mine, otherwise I'm going to stall out. And I sort of got the feel of it. But if I were to try to teach you how to drive a car and explain how you do it, I could tell you, but you're going to stall out a bunch of times. You're not going to do it the first time. You need to practice. Same thing about I could tell you how to do a Taekwondo kick or how to how to fence or something like that. But I could tell you, but you're not going to be any good at it unless you practice a lot. Or play the violin. I play the violin, and you're not going to know how to play the violin just by somebody telling you, oh, you just draw the bow across the strings like this, right? So anyway, and ethics is like that. It's not something you can just read in a book and just go out and do. You need to use your judgment. You need to practice trying to be ethical, trying to exercise moderation and self-control in lots of different ways, and to fail a lot. Okay, criticisms. Oh, the whole, purpose of nature. Is there a purpose in nature? Does it sort of assume a designing mind or a God? That might be kind of iffy. Is there a virtue for every moral value? What about this whole idea that it's wrong to steal other people's stuff? So how are you going to explain that in virtue ethics? Stealing is wrong.
Like honesty?
Well.
Because you're cheating yourself.
What if you steal other people's stuff, and if they ever ask you, you say, "Yeah, I stole it." I mean, honesty has to do with truth telling. It doesn't really have to do with taking other people's stuff.
I had a chance to take protractor, and mine is broken.
Uh-huh.
I came in class, and it was like Monday. There's one sitting right there, not broken.
Uh-huh.
Almost took it. I was like, "Wait, this is like the calculus book."
Uh-huh.
And I don't really know why I didn't take it, except that I'm trying to be conscious of the things I'm learning in this class.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I probably would have taken it. They're like 50 cents, you know?
Yeah, so it's like practice of being ethical.
Yeah, but I don't know
stealing.
What virtue that is.
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, what? So if you try to make a virtue out of not stealing, like, what would it be? Would it be, that's about truth-telling. Mm-hmm. Integrity is about your outward behavior matching your inward value system, but what's the value? Like, it's too much of something and not enough of something, right? So it's an extreme between excess and deficiency. So, but what's the thing that there's too much of or too little of? Taking other people's stuff or respecting property rights? But it seems like property rights is a separate deal then. Like, you've got some new idea of a right that's alongside virtue. So the idea is that virtue ethics can't do anything, and maybe you need to glom it on to Kant or something like that. It's a problem that there have been a bunch of different solutions to, but it's kind of they're all kind of clunky. And then the whole Aristotle is a classist and a racist and sexist, yada yada.
Yada yada.
Yeah. There's some. Oops. Oh, and that's it. Yeah, so that he's sort of a bourgeois intellectual. I like the word bourgeois. I just like saying it, bourgeois. The bourgeoisie, even though it's like a Marxist term. But it's French. I don't like it because it's Marxist, but I do like it because it's French. Life's full of things like that. Like, you like them in one respect, but you hate them in another respect. Then you get this sort of weird conflict and cognitive dissonance. This is a picture I have of two friends of mine, and one's lighting a cigarette for the other in a hotel where there's no smoking allowed. I like it because they're breaking the rule, but I really hate smoking. And this guy is like, he's a freaking idiot. He started smoking at 40, having like never smoked in his life just for the hell of it. Because it's, I guess, because it's anarchic or anarchistic or something, or just it's just because he can, and that just seems like that just seems wrong. Anyway, but I love the picture. It's a great picture. It's taken by a third friend of mine. I should bring that in. That's a great photo. Okay, I will. Nah, it's there's all sorts of good things going on. Like, you could see kind of that they're friends. You can see mischief, you can see intimacy, there's like all sorts of things playing, and like the lines of the eyes, it's just, I think it should get a prize or something. It should win a contest. Yeah.
Is your friend a photographer?
The photographer I know, I just like know him, I don't call him a friend. The other two guys I know better. One of the guys I know pretty well. They're all at Libertopia. Libertopia is a big, it's mostly anarchist libertarian conference in San Diego. Totally awesome. Everybody's into like the Bitcoin and the underground economy, and everybody was talking about how great the Silk Road is, and like a few days later it, went down the tubes.
The Silk Road?
Yeah.
There's a modern one?
Yeah, so what's this? Tell everybody what the Silk Road is.
I don't know like a lot about it, but it's just like they would sell like illegal it's just like a huge.
Like if you want to buy drugs or whatever. It's like the Pirate Bay for like drugs or contraband or weapons or whatever, you know, whatever you want to get. All the stuff that's banned.
Like a black market?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a black market thing. So anyway. You know, a lot of people that don't believe in rules, no gods, no masters, all that kind of stuff. So
what does dichotomy mean? Dichotomy?
Dichotomy? It's a radical separation between two things. Did I just use the word dichotomy in a sentence?
He used it earlier, between egoism and altruism.
Oh, okay, the dichotomy between egoism and altruism. So the idea is that they're, egoism and altruism are totally different things. It's either you choose yourself or you choose other people. So either I'm going to do something that's good for me or I'm going to do something that's good for society. And Aristotle says, no, if you do what's good for you, you're going to be doing what's good for society. Because what's good for you, being a successful person. How do you do that? Develop your talents and abilities, cultivate virtue, be productive, use your mind, all that stuff. So here's Nietzsche, died in 1900, 19th century. Yeah, so there's a lot of speculation about what killed poor old Freddie Nietzsche. One is that he got syphilis like the one time he had sex with a prostitute, like in his whole life. And, it made him go insane later in life. There's other speculations about what he might have had. He ended up in a sanatorium like the last years of his life. Very intense. Look at the eyes. And look at the crazy mustache too, right? And the cowlick hair, Ed Grimley hair. And all of his pictures, though, he's got these sort of like glaring eyes. Here, as a young man, looking maybe a little more thoughtful. That's crazy. He's German. He's a little later in life. College professor. Yeah, isn't that a stash? It's fitting for Movember.
The No Shave Movember.
Here's another one.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
It's like a small.
Imagine like trying to eat like minestrone soup with that. Mm-hmm. And you probably get like all the little beans would be like caught in there and they'd be dropping out at long after you've eaten. So Nietzsche's the first really postmodern philosopher we looked at. Postmodern philosophy is by and large a bunch of crap, but Nietzsche I think is the exception. He is kind of relativistic in his thinking in some ways, but in other ways he sort of has an absolute, the will to power and the Übermensch and the idea of overcoming. So he's, even though he's postmodern, he has a sort of irrational side to him, he's a wonderful writer. He writes with passion and there is a method to his madness, and he is... he does try to be logical, but he falls into sort of the postmodern category, which basically means the postmodern category sort of says, the modernistic era was the age of science and the age of reason, and the postmodern is where science and reason are kind of abandoned for some other things. So. He cut his teeth on classical philosophy, Greco-Roman philosophy, had his issues with Plato. He wrote his first book was called The Birth of Tragedy, all about the Greek tragic playwrights, Sophocles, Aeschylus, Euripides. So he started out as a philologist, and he talks about the split between these two impulses in human culture, Apollo and Dionysus. And it's kind of like a neat thing to think about. Like Apollo is sort of reason and learning, enlightenment, and it's sort of structure and order. And then Dionysus is sort of like chaos, being wild and unbridled. And he talks about like how those two kind of forces of order and chaos kind of play out in Greek tragedy. It's a kind of interesting book. Later on, Nietzsche didn't like it. He said the stench of Schopenhauer was still in my nostrils when I wrote that. It was this other German philosopher. So he felt like he hadn't fully come into his own as a philosopher and was in the shadow of these other philosophers and thought it was kind of a derivative work and not that great. But a lot of people into literary criticism love The Birth of Tragedy. It's kind of thick reading, but it's got some interesting ideas. And the main thing I walked away from that was the Apollo and Dionysus thing. And sometimes you can think like it's kind of interesting to look at your personality and see the Apollonian parts and the Dionysian parts. And he talks about that a bit too, these two impulses in human nature.
Yeah,
and
I think I've been struggling with those two.
Uh-huh. Yeah, reason and passion, you might call them. So similar to Aristotle in a lot of ways. He has a teleological theory. He's all about the individual. We'll talk about maybe some other similarities. Oh, and then virtue ethics. He's also got a form of virtue ethics. But because his system is so different from Aristotle's he's kind of in a category all his own. So he doesn't really fit into virtue ethics per se, but similar to Aristotle. So the teleology and the virtue ethics. But because he's so different from every other philosopher looked at, I kind of put him in his own category. Some people even suggested Nietzsche's not really a philosopher because he kind of just rants and raves about things and isn't very systematic. And some people say he's writing literature. He wrote this kind of philosophical novels, maybe like Rand. Actually, Ayn Rand was an early devotee of Nietzsche. And kind of you read her early stuff, it's very dark, a lot like Nietzsche. And then she kind of turned over and had sort of Nietzsche with a benevolent twist and a capitalistic twist, I guess. But also just like the early on, it's all about the individual and overcoming and crushing anyone in their way. And later on, it's like, no, that the individual needs to cooperate with others and that will lead to, you know, human happiness. But her early stuff's kind of dark. And it was like a lot of this was the influence of Nietzsche. But she kept the egoism, she kept the anti-Christian views and the anti-altruistic views of Nietzsche. And I think he was a pretty big influence. A friend of mine, Stephen Hicks, wrote a great paper on this comparing Nietzsche and Ayn Rand. Really interesting stuff. Maybe I'll see if I can find it and post that to Moodle for anybody who's interested. Is that a word? This is just going on. This is just something I talked about earlier on. So I guess I put it in here the last time I did this as a review. So this is just stuff I already said. So Christianity adopts Aristotle as a kind of patron saint. And then Aquinas just calls him the philosopher. So he'll say, you know, he always starts out with a question and answer. Some people say that blah, blah, blah. The philosopher says, who's the philosopher? Well, Aristotle, the philosopher. Aquinas basically using Aristotle as basis of his philosophy. And we talked about, it's just like a different version of... Actually, this is a more elaborate version of the differences, so maybe I'll just leave these all up here. So, Christian virtues versus pagan or classical virtues. Pagan, I suppose, is a pejorative term. That's kind of hard to see. I'll turn on this light. So this one. That's better.
It's just so weird because this is what... church is supposed to be based on, but it's not. I mean, like, we have a whole nation of Christian people who were at holy war to them. So, and I mean, it's not loving your enemy. It's like, kill those, love them, and bomb them, and crucify them like Christ. I've seen this stuff like, on the internet, so it's just strange to me.
Yeah, there was, I heard that aspect. I think that's sort of like an Americanized version of Christianity. I don't really think it represents like the mainstream of Christianity, though, in America. Like hatred all the Christians I know, they all want to convert the Muslims. They don't want to kill them or bomb them. They want to make sure that they're not bombing us and killing us, and they don't want a nuclear, they don't want a mushroom cloud going up over Los Angeles or something, but they don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon.
It's a vocal minority.
but I'm an atheist and I don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon either. That really frightens me.
Well, yeah.
The media just grabs most ignorant and impossible
things. Yeah, but I mean, you look at somebody like, you know, George W. Bush, is sort of dubbed as a warmonger and you know, attacked Iraq with on the whole WMD things. But even Bush, you know, what was his speech was, you know, freedom is the yearning of the human spirit, and the idea was to depose Saddam and set up a democratic government where people would have human rights in Iran, not to like carpet bomb the place and kill everybody and get those Muslims. So. But, I mean, there are people, there are haters in every religion.
I think they tend to stick out because they have the most intensity.
Because yeah. They type in all caps.
Okay, yeah. It's a,
yeah.
They type in all caps. It gets people's attention. So, again, humility is a virtue versus pride in ancient Greece. Poverty is a virtue versus wealth.
Does this have to do with Nietzsche at all?
This is the Christian spin on Aristotle. And so I'm going to talk about how Nietzsche wants to put ethics back more towards the Aristotelian version. And so this is all about Christianity, and a lot of Nietzsche is a reaction to Christianity and Christian values. It's interesting to me, too, that people that say that money is important always want to borrow some from you. I should be a dead horse with personal examples here. They're like, oh, all you care about is money. Can I have some? Religious faith versus intellectual activity. Unconditional love, loving your enemies, versus, like, you know, crushing your enemies. Or at least, you know, fighting your enemies. And there also is this tendency in Christianity towards asceticism. Asceticism is denying bodily wants for spiritual purpose. So in the extreme form, you have people who would, like, go out in the desert and fast for days on end. And people, these guys called the flagellants, who would they would take, like, whips and whip their backs bloody. To feel bad about their sins. People would sit up on pillars in the middle of the desert, just all kinds of stuff. Even Martin Luther was, you know, would climb up the steps of this church, these harsh cobblestone steps on his knees until they were bloody from being, like, cut and abrased from the rough stone before he kind of woke up. All sorts of... And just like the idea of, you know, oh, you know, sex is reserved for marriage and procreation, and it's probably better not to get married at all. You should, like, become a monk. That's kind of the ideal. And the same thing about, like, eating and drinking. You shouldn't, like, don't be a glutton. But the idea of, like, Aristotle says don't be a glutton or you'll ruin your health in the kind of extreme asceticism of Christianity, it's like, don't enjoy your food too much because you want to put your food before God, or make sure you give thanks to your food. Like, oh, Thanksgiving comes around and somebody said, what are you going to do for Thanksgiving? And I'm like, well, no, whatever. I'm like, I'm on the regimen. I don't want to ruin it by being a glutton. And they're like, you're supposed to be thankful. I said, do. I think that's something Nietzsche might say, like, to who? And the whole idea of giving thanks, it sort of assumes an object. For in Christianity, it's like the emphasis is on being grateful for all the things God has done for you, as opposed to taking pride in what you've done for yourself. And then this courage gets reinterpreted as fighting the devil, fighting off temptation, you know, not letting that temptress talk you into bed, right? Resisting the temptation to steal that 50-cent protractor that you could really use.
It wasn't because of God, maybe. I don't know.
You see the little demon on your shoulder, like, tempting you, saying, come on, it's only 50 cents.
No, I was saying you need one. Yours is broken.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. And they're not going to come back and get it anyway, right?
I don't think so. It's not there, though.
Kant would say there's that elaborate facade of rationalizations that, you know, crops up every time you try to think in utilitarian terms. So Nietzsche is very famous in saying the phrase "God is dead." Anybody ever see the bumper sticker? It says, "God is dead, Nietzsche. Nietzsche is dead, God." So kind of funny. So what did Nietzsche mean that when he says God is dead? You want to take a shot at this? What does it mean? What does Nietzsche say? It mean he says God is dead. That's part of it. Let's see. The Parable of the Madman. Actually, could I borrow somebody's any other book with them? I didn't bring mine with me. It's out in the car. I'm trying to slide for a minute.
Nietzsche is a lot more fun to read than Aristotle, in my opinion. Yeah. Aristotle is very dry and boring.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's good stuff, but it reads like a textbook. Nietzsche, like, it's part of the Parable of the Madman. Here it is. This is from Joyful Wisdom.
This is from a Joyful Wisdom. Unfortunately, translated The Gay Science in the 50s by Walter Kaufman. So, gay means something completely different today. Anyway, Joyful Wisdom is probably a better translation. I published as a gay science, right? So I don't know if the future editions they changed it or if it's just other translators. But I like Joyful Wisdom, so I changed it with a note. So the Parable of the Madman. The Madman. Have you heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, "I seek God! I seek God!" As many there were who did not believe in God standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. Has he got lost? They're talking about God now. Did he lose his way like a child? Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage, emigrated? Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. You know, just like Nietzsche, right? And said, "Where is God? I will tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how did we do this? How did we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained the earth from the sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there any up or down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Do we hear as yet nothing of the noise of the grave diggers who are burying God, who smell nothing as yet of the divine decomposition? God's decomposed too. God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of the world has yet owned and bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe off the blood from us? What water is there to clean ourselves? Here the madman, and fell silent and looked again at his listeners, and they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern on the ground and broke it to pieces, and it went out. "I have come too early," he said to them. "My time is not yet." This tremendous event is on its way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. These, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves. And then at the end there's this comment, what after all these churches now if they are not tombs and sepulchres of God? So reading this story, like what's Nietzsche's point? What's the parable about? like any aspect of it. What does he? What does this guy mean when he says we've killed God?
We created God, and then people who have started to disbelieve in him killed him, or not disbelieve, but like realize that he's not real.
Yeah, people realize that there is no God. How do they do that? Well, they're like making jokes, like, you know, they're. It's not like they think, there might be a God, or maybe there's something to it, but I'm not really sure. It's like, you know, the guy's yelling, "Where is God?" And they're like, "Oh, maybe he, emigrated to Singapore, right, for the low tax rate." Or maybe he's lost and he can't find his mommy, right? You know, people are making jokes about God, and to them it's like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny.
They typically respect God.
Yeah, that's part. Well, it's because they don't respect God because they think God exists. They're just like totally beyond their comprehension that there might be a God. Like it's like an adult believing Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. Now, why? Think about like the context of the time. This is like the 19th century. It's the height of the Industrial Revolution, on the cusp. What did the Industrial Revolution fall on the heels of?
Renaissance.
After the Renaissance, before the Industrial Revolution. Nope. That was actually that was in the 19th century too. That was a step back. The Renaissance is sort of comes before the Age of Reason, the Scientific Revolution. So you get around, you know, late Renaissance, I guess maybe you get the so-called Age of Reason. You get the scientific method. Right. What's that?
Like when Newton was alive, Isaac.
Oh, Isaac Newton.
Yeah, he was like
Victorian's a lot later. That's like late 19th century. Newton, I think, is still... I have to look up his dates. Any science geeks in here? But it's, you know, the Age of Reason, basically, like, on the heels of the Renaissance. Renaissance, you know, 15th, 16th century. Age of Reason, 17th, 18th century, where you have the beginnings of modern science. You have Francis Bacon, scientific method. You have, you know, the beginnings of industry and factories and advanced technology, the steam engine, and so all this stuff is and mass production of material goods. And so as learning and science and reason sort of take precedence, faith is kind of falling away, and in Europe it's on the way out. And so the parable of the madman is all about God being on his way out. Nobody believes in God anymore. Essentially, like, how would you translate God? God is dead really means... do I have that up here? Maybe I don't. Yeah, but it's not God himself, right? God never existed. It's not like God was once alive and lived a full life and then died of old age, or that actually human beings assassinated him collectively. God never existed. Yeah.
It's kind of like Santa Claus, you know. Santa Claus never existed, but I feel like every year there's like kids know like quicker that he's not real.
Yeah. Kind of
like that.
My nephew, I think it took them until he was about like 12 or 13 until he figured it out. He's a little slow on the uptake. maybe not 13. I think he was like, maybe he was 11 or 12, something like that. But just a little slow on the uptake. So the parable of the madman is all about God is dead really means faith in God is dead. That nobody believes in God anymore, would be another way of putting it. And sorry, I don't have that up on my PowerPoint. I think I saved myself from putting it up there so I didn't give it away. So because nobody believes in God anymore and sort of Christian morality is on its way out along with it, there's a need for new values. And Nietzsche makes the point that what's going on is, oops, I don't want that yet. What's going on is that people still believe in Christian values even though they don't believe in the Christian God. And there's this kind of schizophrenia where people laugh at the idea of there being a God, but they still believe in love your neighbor as yourself. They still believe that your whole purpose in life is to serve humanity. What's everybody else's purpose? Well, to serve you. You know, what's your purpose? To serve everybody else. What's their purpose? To serve you. It's sort of like, well, where is like the ultimate value? It seems like kind of weird that everybody's duty in life is to serve everybody else. And where does that come from? Well, it comes, you know, from Christianity. And Nietzsche says, now that we live in the age of reason and science, and it's all about human achievement and knowledge, and you know, Darwinian evolution, the idea of evolution starting to come out, you need new values. And so, again, there's this influence from Aristotle, classical philosophy, and Nietzsche says these values are going to come from like humanist. They're going to be humanistic values, based on what the good for man is, not some fictitious being, you know, the big man up in the sky. They're going to come from human nature. And for Aristotle, for Nietzsche, the big value is the will to power, which I'll give you a definition of later on. But it's basically the inner striving of the human spirit. Maybe I should more accurately like quote George W. Bush, the inner yearning of the human spirit. You know, he said it's freedom. Nietzsche would say it's the will to power, which is this idea you want to grow and dominate and prosper and control and crush anything in your way. You seize the day, I guess. Nietzsche calls himself the world's greatest immoralist. So by this, Nietzsche likes making a lot of little jokes. He's kind of sarcastic and cynical. And so when he's calling himself an immoralist, people who would write books about ethics would call themselves moralists. And today a moralist has a negative connotation. But at the time, being a moralist was just a person who talked about virtue and ethics and all the good things in life and being a good person. And it didn't have the sort of negative connotation of wagging your finger at some people and telling them they were bad. So Nietzsche says, well, I'm writing a book on a moral philosophy. Everybody else writes is a moralist. I'm an immoralist. Why? Because he's going to turn values upside down. And he thinks that society is screwed up because of Christianity. And Christianity has all these backward values which tell you that everything good in life is bad and that everything bad in life is good. And Nietzsche says, I'm going to fix it. I'm going to... Now, to you, I'm going to look like this terrible person. Why? Because you've embraced this screwed up value system. And so that's why I'm going to seem like the bad person and you're not going to like me. But really, and so this is kind of a weird paradox where he's saying, I'm an immoralist. I'm going to tell you all the things that you think are bad, but they're actually good. And what Nietzsche's really trying to do is turn values on their heads and get people to see that, oh no, those things that you think are bad are actually good, and those things you think are good are actually bad. Just what I just said, it turns value and virtue on its head. You think humility is a virtue? No, humility is a vice. That's bad. You have low self-esteem. You think sacrifice is good? No, sacrifice is horrible. You think conserving water in Oregon, where it falls on your head most of the year, and you see like a little sign in front of the tap that says, every drop is precious, conserve, conserve, conserve. Don't use too much, make yourself smaller, don't be greedy, right? And you're like, oh, you know, I'll just turn on the tap and just get enough to my... Should I wash out my coffee? I'll just kind of rinse it and move my little finger there. I'll fill up this much, you know, and kind of move my finger around there. I don't want to use any soap because that's, you know, soap's the product of industrial process. Maybe I'll just kind of wipe it down with a dirty cloth, and, right? Because why? Oh, you don't want to waste water. And so the idea is make yourself small and, you know, drive a Prius and... Don't put carbon to the air because that's going to just spoil the pristine earth. And make yourself small and don't affect anything around you. It doesn't matter. It would be best if you just killed yourself. But if you're not going to do that, just try to make yourself really small. Don't affect the world in any way. Don't harm anything. Make sure when you're like, don't ever, you know, when you're walking the grass, make sure you don't like bend down the blades of grass, stay off the grass, and don't like, you know, make sure not to step on a snail and don't ever swat a fly. Like this sort of obsession with like not harming anything in the world, of making yourself small and ineffectual towards the world. And that's sort of Nietzsche sees that as his sort of character of like what Christianity is saying. You're bad and wrong, and you should feel lousy about yourself and hope that you don't go to hell and so on and so forth. And so he thinks about conventional morality as anti-nature. He thinks, like, as a natural person, what do? You want to grab the gusto. You want to enjoy carnal relations with the opposite sex, or maybe the same sex, depending on what floats your boat. You want to enjoy eating and drinking and having fun with your friends, of engaging in sporting contests, and just like think about your sort of animalistic needs. You enjoy, you know, the stuff you enjoy doing, pleasant diversions, taking a long warm bath. Just all the things, and whereas Christianity says, oh, you shouldn't think about yourself, you shouldn't take time for yourself, you should be out there at the soup kitchen helping a bunch of drunks and homeless people. So he thinks that it's, but it goes against nature to make a person feel bad about themselves all the time, to make them think about other people all the time. Look at nature, look at animals. Do they act like that? Does the lion pity the gazelle? No, the lion chases the gazelle, pounces on it, and rips its belly open and eats. And feasts. And that's metaphorically is what he thinks human beings should do with life. That should be your attitude. You should be like you should embrace your nature as a predator. Man is a predatory animal and should act as such. Yeah.
Do you see the religion and the church in the same way? You know how a lot of churches might be real negative and make you feel bad.
Yeah.
This and that, but I kind of tend to separate those two in a lot of issues.
Yeah, I think he just thinks about this in general as Christendom and doesn't really make any distinctions and kind of paints all Christians with a broad brush and maybe unfairly. Well, not maybe, definitely unfairly. So, I mean, he's going against sort of some of the broad teachings of Christianity, and particularly as they existed in, you know, European society. But you might think that, you know, there's sort of there's humanistic stuff in the Bible too, but Nietzsche doesn't make a distinction between like what's in the Bible and how it's expressed in culture and the church. And maybe you might argue, but I do think that you find lots of passages in the Bible that sort of feed into what Nietzsche's arguing. He just like sort of cherry picks the most extreme ones and then, you know, pushes them. But to be fair, the Bible has other stuff that kind of balances that out in some ways, but I don't know. We could talk about that. I want to just hit a few more things. His book, The Genealogy of Morals, tries to show like where morality comes from. And basically, morality, you get two systems of morality. One for masters and one for the slaves. So way back when human civilization started, you had masters and slaves. Some people were in charge, other people were not. They were working for them. You had a pecking order, you had alpha wolves, and you had the beta wolves and gamma wolves and, you know, the epsilon wolves, with the zeta wolves, the one at the bottom. So you had all the, basically, leaders and followers.
Were you born into this?
It's a good question about whether masters are born and not made. I think Nietzsche thinks that biology plays a big part of that. He's really into sort of the idea of evolution and that biology and physiology matters. But I think that maybe he thinks there's room to change within that. So it's an interesting question. But by and large, he seems to think that masters are born and not made. But he's not, in this book, I don't think he focuses on that. It's more of just like, look how people turned out. And some people, so the masters, in order to rule, you need certain qualities. And in order to serve, you need certain qualities. And so you get two parallel systems. So you have the masters, the rulers, and nobility. And what do you need? Well, you need to be, and then the slaves, who are like the peasants or actual slaves, you know, literal slaves. And each group has its own set of moral rules. And so master morality is essentially the morality that Nietzsche is embracing. And then slave morality is the morality of Christianity. I should have stuck more down at the bottom. Now I have to hit a new slide here. Yeah. So the slaves are the ruled are the peasants are the literal slaves. Masters, the rulers, or the nobility. You know, inherited, right? So the cream rises to the top. So even if you're not born, you know, to the right family, if like, and Nietzsche recognizes this too, that you might not have noble blood, but if you're a noble person, you're going to rise to the top, regardless of your rank and how you're born. So what do you have to do to be a leader? You need strength, vitality. You can't be like weak and anemic and kind of wimpy. You know, you can't be like Bush the father, right? You need ambition, right? That was a big thing. He was a wimp, right? That was the.
Yeah, but he still was part of the ruling class.
Right. So I guess the idea is that, you know, if you want to be a good leader, you have to. You have to show strength and authority. You need to project strength to others.
So Clinton was born to the other class. He rose up into that.
Yeah, so that might be a good example of the cream rising the crop. I remember there was a story about Clinton that he used to stare in a mirror and tell lies and try not to look like he was lying, like he would practice over and over again. That's a great politician. So, but yeah, he was born in Hot Springs, Arkansas, he was raised in Hot Springs. He was born in Hope, so he's like the man from Hope, which makes a good story. But actually, he grew up in Hot Springs, which is sort of like the Las Vegas of Arkansas, and, you know, to a kind of poor family. But he had innate talents and abilities that he honed, and Nietzsche would say maybe he was born to a low station, but he rose because of what was within him. Self-control, I mean, that's good with the Clinton example, right? So, you know, Clinton got impeached, lost his law license, why? No self-control in the sexual arena.
But people still love him.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he's still around today, right? But, you know, so he still maybe overall was a good leader, but that was like a big lapse. And to be the really, you know, the best leader, you want to try to avoid those things.
I don't know why it was in the inverted business.
Perjure yourself in court, yeah. That's kind of trying to fix a sexual harassment lawsuit. That's kind of a big deal. So it's not just lying about having sex. It's lying in court to avoid paying out on a lawsuit for sexually harassing a subordinate employee. But let's not get into politics. Intelligence. You also need to be kind of an optimistic person. You need to glory in life. If you're all depressed and moping around, you're going to be a lousy leader. You need to sort of embrace life and that's like part and parcel of all these other things. He thinks that if you look at leaders have to be positive. They have to have the initiative, because if you're depressed, what are you going to do? You're going to like mope around and think, oh, what's the use? That's slave mentality. And also honesty is a master virtue. And it's being honest with other people and yourself. I think that Nietzsche's idea is that who lies? Weak people. People that can't tell the truth because they're worried about what other people will think or what other people will do. A person who's innately powerful, self-confident, and in control, he'll tell people whatever the hell they want. If they don't like it, they can lump it. And they're also not going to engage in an elaborate facade of rationalizations trying not to harm their fragile self-esteem. They're going to be honest with themselves about their faults, about their problems, about their situation, and then they're going to do something about it. Weak people lie to themselves, and they make up stories, and they say, I'm cleaning toilets right now as a janitor, but someday I'll be ruling in heaven with Jesus. Hallelujah, right? And it sort of gives you the strength to clean the next toilet. When in reality, Nietzsche would say, if you're a master, you'd say, I'm cleaning toilets. My life sucks. You know, but then if you're a master, you wouldn't be cleaning toilets probably. So, and then also a certain sense of callousness. If you spend all your time thinking about other people, you're not really ruling. You're going to be weak, and nobody's going to respect you. So that's also part of being a master. I think that's all we have time for. We'll pick up the slave mentality next time. Slave mentality, slave morality. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Be grateful for what you have to yourself, for all the things you've created, or for the things that fortune has brought you.